Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on April the 14th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we are happy to welcome Thaddeus Pope, who is professor of law and director of the Health Law Institute at Hamlin Law. Thad curates a particularly useful website, Medical Futility and Non-Beneficial Treatment Cases, at thaddeuspope.com, and also authors the Medical Futility blog. He's one of the country's leading scholars on end of life issues. Welcome, Thad.
Thanks for inviting me, Nick and Frank.
Well, our format is simple. Health law topics tend to be a bit more challenging. Frank, what's bugging you this week?
Well, this week I thought that something that is very topical and the heat is on the FDA. There has been a number of reports about an ingredient called BMPEA, which is something that is very close to an amphetamine, and that appears to be added to lots of weight loss and workout products. And the problem now is that essentially the FDA suspected this and they got tip-offs, but they didn't recall products, name them, or issue a health alert. And so even while the Canadian health authorities were, you know, finding these chemicals a serious health risk and alerting the public, our FDA was not. And the worry a lot of folks is having that is that, you know, trade groups like the Natural Products Association, the supplement makers and others who, you know, were instrumental back in the early 90s in getting DSHEA passed, the Dietary Supplements Health and Education Act, which sort of deregulated their area, that they have a persistent influence and are preventing the FDA from really educating the public, which is, you know, the minimal regulatory strategy empowered by the DSHEA. So this is a really interesting area, I think, because it raises some very difficult questions for the FDA. It raises questions that we've talked about in past health podcasts about the jurisdictional boundaries between, say, the Federal Trade Commission and the FDA. And I just thought it would be a great way to kick us off, because the question becomes, you know, is there any energy in Congress to do something here? Is there energy in the agency to do something? Or does it seem as though essentially this is an area of law that's going to continue to be adrift?
The background, of course, is unlike the case with drugs. There is no requirement that the FDA does a pre-sale investigation to see whether the drug either is safe for use or... And I think this is kind of the issue that we discussed a few weeks ago, Frank, whether this product is indeed effective, whether it does what it says on the label. The position is quite different in Europe, where supplements like this are regulated as foods by the European Food Safety Authority. The main EU legislation, a directive, which handles food supplements that contains vitamins and minerals, sets out labeling requirements, maximum and minimum levels for each sort of product ingredient. And then there's sort of an annex, which is updated, which contains a list of sort of the substances that are actually permitted in any of these products. And we seem to be missing out on all of that. So it's sort of self-help, I'm afraid. And I don't know about you, but I think the NIH page on dietary supplements and the Consumer Reports ones are the ones that I would go to before touching any of this stuff.
Yes, I think it's really worrisome, you know, because I think that we see there's a lot of folks that are out there that are, I think, assuming that there is a lot more regulation, monitoring, understanding of the area than there actually is. And I know that there was this very big controversy about Attorney General Schneiderman apparently revealing that in many of the supplements there wasn't even the effective ingredient. Then there's sort of a pushback from the industry saying that, well, you did DNA tests, but you really should have done different types of tests. It just seems as though there's like this continuing murk in the area. And it really worries me that essentially, you know, you could have something like DSHEA preempting some really important action by the FDA here. I expect the FTC, and the other funny thing that's an interesting parallel is the FTC has been sort of moving into areas that were traditionally thought of as the FCC's role with some of its cases against the big telcos, big telecom companies. And I expect it's just going to keep doing more of this in the supplement area. because the industry is pretty powerful in it.
So Frank, you referenced the recent New York Attorney General action, and I'm wondering, even the mere fact that you even have such an action, does that suggest that there's not complete federal preemption here, and that we consumers can take some salvage in looking to the states to protect us, even if we can't look to the federal government to protect us from unsafe dietary supplements?
That is such a terrific angle on it, Thad, and I completely agree. And the Schneiderman, you know, in the New York action, not only was revealing things, but ordered four major retailers to stop selling these store brand herbal supplements because of his DNA barcode test. And I think that that is going to be an increasingly important model here for lots of these areas, because it's just going to be so important for the states to step in. And, you know, it may well be that consumer advocates are going to ask the federal government just to get out of the state's way if California, New York, others can intervene. I do, though, want to note that, doing some work in the internet area, I recently read this really interesting article about the potential dormant commerce clause challenges to California's online eraser law for child privacy, giving children the right to take stuff down that they had put on social networks before age 18. And I do worry that essentially if there's too much regulatory energy or legislative energy invested at the state level, that's going to be an open invitation to further sort of structural federalism claim challenges to that effective regulatory regime.
So since you've started pushing dark clouds over the conversation, Frank, let me add another small one. I think we've both been quite impressed by the way that the FTC has been pushing out of its traditional areas and entering domains that we otherwise had thought were elsewhere regulated by the federal government. But I'm afraid the dark cloud that one has to remember is the FTC is not very popular on the Hill. And secondly, is not a very well-funded or staffed agency. The people there are extremely talented, but they do not have the resources to go after sort of every whack-a-mole that agency capture or bad federal legislation has led to pop up. So, Thad, the right to die debate, which I think was reinvigorated somewhat with the emergence of NPR's Diane Rehm as something of a celebrity advocate following the very sad death of her husband by dehydration, reportedly as his Parkinson's became intolerable. Can you tell us what issues that particular circumstance raises, and perhaps then go on and talk about those that maybe it only does so indirectly?
Sure. So this is, and I think she stepped back now because of NPR, but for a period of time, she was a very prominent, invisible advocate, and specifically, she was an advocate for physician aid in dying. And what that usually signifies is a person with decision-making capacity who's terminally ill and who wants to get a prescription for a lethal dose of barbiturates that they'll consume that will cause their death. That's what she wanted for her husband. That's what he wanted for himself because his Parkinson's had advanced. He couldn't move his arms, couldn't move his legs, and basically wanted to die. Didn't find his life worthwhile. Found his life intolerable. But in the state of Maryland, where they live, their doctor would not prescribe a lethal dose of barbiturates because assisted suicide is illegal in every state. Except for Vermont, Washington, and Oregon. And so, as you said, he nevertheless, despite that, still hastened his death, but did so by just voluntarily stopping eating and drinking and dehydrated to death in about 9 days. So the issues that it raises are, A, is about what more than 25 states are doing right now in this legislative session, which is to consider legalizing physician aid in dying. And the other thing that this highlights is the status of the way that Mr. Rehm actually did die, which is by voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. Diane Rehm said, I think the quote was, that was an inexcusable way to die. It's not right. And many advocates for physician aid in dying denigrate the peacefulness and the comfort of VSAID, VS, voluntary stopping eating and drinking, VSAID, as an exit option in order to highlight the necessity to legalize physician aid in dying.
So is VSAID, as we know it today, is that legal? Or is the question of its legality clear?
Well, let me – so in Mr. Rehm's case, VSAID was legal. And the idea here is all you're doing is you're foregoing water for the most part. I mean, people say it's starving to death, but really it's the water. It's the dehydration that's the key factor. And you're allowed to refuse anything, right? People can't force you to take any medical treatment. They can't force you to drink. That would be a battery, a tort, in that they can't do that. And so you do have the right, if you still have decision-making capacity, to refuse food and water if you want. Okay, but people like Mr. Rehm, you want to have a clinician overseeing this to make sure that it really is a peaceful and comfortable process. And they're treating the underlying illness that you have, the Parkinson's, while during the 7 to 10 days that it takes for the VSAID to work. And many clinicians are concerned. So there's a perception that it's not legal, right? So I want to make clear, I think most of the scholars who have thought about this have concluded that it is legal, but on the part of many clinicians, hospice workers, other clinicians who might need to be involved, they're reluctant to be involved because of their perception that it might be not legal.
That perception issue is such a difficult one, and it's something that I always find, you know, in teaching the area, a lot of students are quite reasonably looking for some way of giving people a comfort letter or some sort of signal that their actions are going to be, you know, not going to lead to problematic legal outcomes, either for them or the institution that they work for. And could you discuss some of those options, that, or is that sort of something? I know that you have blogged often on MOLSTs and POLSTs and other forms of advanced directives in the area, and I'm just wondering if you could describe any advances there or a lack of advance and a sense of permanent intractability in the area.
So I think this is an area that people do have this incredible risk averseness, and I mean by clinicians, physicians, nurses, other types of clinicians. And while it's not necessary, they really want I refer to this simplistically as a green light, right? They there's no red light that's prohibiting VSAID, for example, or prohibiting them from complying with a MOLST order or complying with an advanced directive, but what they really want is not the absence of a red light, the absence of a prohibition. They really want a green light that affirmatively, explicitly clarifies that it is okay to be involved with this, to do this. And I think that's because healthcare is so incredibly regulated that the absence of an explicit regulation on something almost leads to the inference that if it hasn't been explicitly addressed and permitted, that it must not be prohibited. I mean, and I think that's just an inference that people draw given the incredibly extensive nature of regulation. And so I think in many instances we are adding more and more green lights, even though it's really not necessary. We're adding safe harbors, safe harbor legal immunity to do things when there really was almost zero legal risk anyway. But again, people just want to know, if I comply with an advance directive, if I comply with a physician order for life-sustaining treatment, in good faith, I have immunity. And they just – that's desired. And if, and again, it's not really a rational perception, but it is a real perception, and therefore you kind of have to react to it, because otherwise they're not going to engage in the behavior that complies with and affects patients' wishes and preferences.
So does this play out differently when, for example, the person suffering from advanced dementia maybe is in a long-term care facility as opposed to being treated at home with a spouse who participated in the advance directive signing and with a sympathetic physician? Does the context change the game?
Well, here's in the long term, here's what really changes the game with VSED is in Mr. Ream's case, and you asked the question, is this legal? And I said, yes, it's legal, although there's a perception that it's not legal. That's when we're talking about a contemporaneous decision by a patient who still has capacity, right? He can just say, and he has the ability to comprehend and understand the decisions that he's making, I don't want to drink. I want to hasten my death. What's very, very common, and this is a very big debate, especially in the long-term care setting, is there are patients who would say today, when they still have capacity, if I have dementia, and if my dementia gets to a point, stage 7 Alzheimer's, for example, where I don't recognize my family, I can't feed myself, I can't go to the bathroom, I don't and you could just define whatever trigger points in your mind would make your life meaningful or not, that you would want to specify in advance, when I get to that point, I wouldn't want to live like that, okay? So the problem is many of people with dementia aren't dependent upon any life-sustaining technology. In other words, they have no organ failure, so there's no ventilator turning off, no dialysis to turn off, right? These are all things they have rights to do, but there's just nothing to turn off because they're not dependent upon any technology. So the only way they can avoid living a life that they would find intolerable is VSED, is to hasten their death. So the question is, can you make an advance VSED decision? And that is, A, in many states, not possible, because when you appoint a healthcare agent in an advance directive or you leave a living will in an advance directive, many state statutes say those vehicles, those instruments are for healthcare decisions. And many state statutes say that oral nutrition and hydration, as opposed to artificial nutrition and hydration, is not healthcare. Okay, and so you just can't make, you can't use the typical instruments of an advance directive to make an advance decision for VSED, because VSED's not a healthcare decision.
That makes a lot of sense, Thad, in terms of the just the legal parsing of it. But I mean, in terms of the policy response, do you think that there is any sort of clear, has any state sort of led the way in terms of enlightened policy response? Or do you think that everyone's sort of just groping their way forward right now?
You're right. There's a big policy question, and this is it, is, and there's a case that was just adjudicated in British Columbia, went up to the appellate court. And what happened is, The patient had left instructions just like this, but when they put the spoon in her mouth now, okay, she does swallow. And what the expert witnesses on the part of the long-term care facility, and the judge found that more credible than her family's witnesses, the judge said, that's her, she's consenting now, okay? So whatever she wrote in her advance directive 5 years ago is revoked by her current expression of a preference to eat, to swallow. And I think that's a big problem, because the person now in their demented state might appear happy, right? Might appear to be satisfied with their life. They do swallow when you put something in their mouth. And the question is, do we honor the prior preferences or do we honor what appear to be the current preferences of this patient? The one state when you ask, has somebody innovated, is Vermont, which has illegally authorized what I think is called there even a Ulysses contract, where you can leave instructions now that would be binding on your future self, right? The same way that Ulysses, when he was on the ship, said, "Tie me to the mast," and when I listen to the beautiful sirens and ask you to untie me, don't listen to me, don't untie me, even though I'm going to be ordering you to do that. And so Vermont does allow you to bind your future self. But that's a very big policy, very big ethics question that's been debated for years by people like Rebecca Dresser and others about whether or not you should be able to bind your future self when it's a very different self.
And I assume that without those kind of that sort of choice architecture put in place, we're going to, if the British Columbia case is any indication, sort of go back into a sort of a Quinlan-like period of indeterminacy, where these cases tend to weave their way through the court system while people are suffering. Is there any chance that sort of the block on assisted suicide is breaking down? Are there any signs that some states have objections that are that sort of a well drafted statute could maybe meet?
Well, so let me, if I could do that in two parts. First, aid in dying, everywhere where it's been legalized in the United States, in every bill in the 25 states that now have pending bills, require that the patient have decision-making capacity at the time that they're making the request and at the time that they consume the prescription. So the legalization of aid in dying is not going to help the dementia population. But to answer your question directly, yes, I think the block is breaking down, right? For 18 years, Oregon has had a successful track record with implementing physician aid in dying in a safe and effective manner. The safeguards to ensure that these are truly voluntary decisions seem to be working. And that's why Washington followed Oregon. That's why Vermont followed Oregon. That's why Montana, the Supreme Court followed. That's why a New Mexico court followed. That's why Quebec legalized aid in dying. And that's why it looks like a number of other bills, for example, in California, are advancing this legislative session. Don't know if any of them are going to ultimately pass, but there's way more legislatures considering way more bills, and those bills are making it into committees at a rate that exceeds any other prior legislative session ever.
Who are there well-known sort of advocacy organizations that are staking out positions on these? I mean, I'm thinking of everyone from AARP to the AMA. Is there anything, any one organization sort of driving these forward?
So on the pro side, on the side of legalizing physician aid in dying, by far out in front above every other organization would be Compassion and Choices. And this is an organization that really spearheaded almost all the laws that there currently exist in the United States. And I think they're behind and informing and funding most of the successful bills in all the other states. On the other side, on the opponent side, you have, when you mentioned the AMA, almost every major professional medical association is against physician aid in dying. Although I don't know that they actively put a lot of effort into opposing it, but their position statements are to oppose it. Actively opposing it, actually putting money and effort, are the Catholic healthcare organizations, and secondly, disability rights organizations. They're concerned that the disabled will be pressured or coerced to hasten their deaths because of a bias on the part of their treating clinicians that their lives aren't worth living. So why don't you just go kill yourself? And so those are the two. It's the religious opposition and the disability opposition.
Well, let's leave that very sad topic. With great thanks to you, Thad, for clarifying so much of it, and move to something that I guess in comparison seems nerdy and relatively unimportant. But there's been some information on the issue of what has become known, because I think it grabs page views, as information blocking. And I guess I should disclose that I serve on the HIT Policy Committee's Consumer Work Group, and the views that follow are purely my own. So this story is not without some irony. As you remember, back in 2009, the HITECH Act set its sights on curing failure in electronic medical record markets, and did so by subsidizing payments through the Meaningful Use Program. And over the years, for all the strengths and weaknesses of meaningful use, one particular issue has stood out as quite a massive failure, and that's the failure to achieve interoperability. And some of us have been arguing for a while now that the problem with electronic medical records has not been market failure, more the fact that the products aren't very good, that it's an underperforming market. So there's long been a suspicion that vendors of and developers of HIT products like EMRs actually saw the lack of interoperability, the ability to promote lock-in, as actually providing some market opportunity. It wasn't until a March 2014 FTC conference that some of these activities actually got their magnificent label of intentional information blocking. And that sparked some congressional interest. December 2014, the Cromnibus bill, the spending bill, actually had a little clause inserted in it demanding that ONC, the Office of the National Coordinator in HHS, deliver a report on information blocking and what they were going to do about it. Meanwhile, the electronic medical record industry seems pretty split as to whether to link proprietary systems or, as I think is probably the better idea, move to a far more standardized data language. Well, this week, we got the ONC blocking report, and it makes for some interesting reading. There isn't much hard evidence about intentional blocking. The report mainly deals with the anecdotal. But ONC apparently received 60 unsolicited reports about blocking. Most complaints were about HIT developers, for example, charging very high fees for making queries between systems or making it very difficult for customers to get their data back if they had the temerity to change vendors. But healthcare providers are not without blame. Some apparently block in order to discourage referrals and so enhance their market dominance. Some do this by using arguably overbroad privacy policies. We also know that providers still shift cost to patients by charging unreasonable fees for records, despite the HIPAA rule. And as you would expect, ONC's solution in their report was to sort of double down on their interoperability plan while reminding the good folks in the industries about fraud and abuse and so on. More interestingly, I think, is that in the same time frame, the FTC, Frank, it's our favorite agency again, the FTC has sent a letter to ONC with regard to interoperability and say it should use its market power to create more demand for interoperability, and so to stimulate competition between developers, to make interoperability a good that will find some market power. The other thing that the FTC urges ONC to do is to caution them from relying too heavily on what the FTC called coordinated governance by market participants, unquote. The FTC noting that that has a tendency to suppress competition. So again, we come back to a sort of agency capture, or at least dominant market participants being involved in governance. So I hope that both of you are wearing your Kenneth Arrow t-shirts. Have some thoughts about either this or about sort of non-performing health markets generally.
So I think that was a wonderful rundown of the issue, Nick. And, you know, I always love teaching this area in my health information privacy course, because there are just so many sort of moves and counter moves that the different parties can make in order to either hoard information or try to force the sharing of the information, et cetera. I just think that we're finding out that we're at the end of the road of market-based reasoning in a lot of these areas. I mean, you could say the flip side about information sharing. You could say there's an incredibly strong market for people to hoard the information or keep it secret, and that's a way of incentivizing the development of their type of proprietary systems. And I just sort of feel like there's got to be a lot more of a governmental role here in articulating, you know, what are legitimate privacy concerns that should restrict data sharing, what are sort of fake or false concerns. And we've got to have a broader vision here of exactly where we're going and whether we want to sort of, in the long term, embrace a great deal more consolidation in the market, because that seems to be almost an inevitable consequence of a lot of the sharing, or if we want to try to forcefully keep it a more fragmented market, where we're going to count on or hope that innovation will be driven by the competition among fragmented entities. And I think that the other side of terms of healthcare markets working or not working, the question that I have too is, a lot of this information, the value of it and the value of sharing is something that is going to accrue over a very long time. You know, you're not going to immediately get a cancer cure from sort of big data research based on information pulled via health information exchanges or in other contexts. And so I, again, you know, wonder what exactly is the rationale behind thinking that there are going to be short-term market incentives for entities to improve interoperability. For me, if anything, the market incentives go in the opposite direction.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Thad Pope for joining us. Thad is at Thaddeus Pope, Thaddeus Pope, on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us, Thad.
Thank you.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry. That's NicolasTerry on Twitter. And Frank, where can they find you?
At Frank Pasquale, Frank PASQALE on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.